I'm showing 559.
Yeah, I just want to get it going in case people are coming in at the last minute. Six o'clock, Jason.
All right. It being 6 o'clock, I'll call the White Salmon City Council meeting of July 1st, 2020 to order. Jan, will you take roll?
Jason Hartman.
Here.
David Lindley.
Here.
Ashley Post.
Here.
Joe Turkowitz. You're muted, Joe.
Here.
Thank you. We have a quorum.
All right. Well, without further ado, we'll get into the agenda. The first item is appointment of an individual to city council position number four.
Jason.
Were yes. there any
public? A couple of things, public comment and changes to the agenda.
Oh, sorry. Thank you. Appreciate it.
There is no public comment.
Oh, wow.
And the one change I have to the agenda is related to appointment of city council member, position number four. We're requesting that be moved to the July 15th meeting to allow more opportunity for applicants to file letters of interest that'll be re-advertised in the newspaper and on the county's webpage.
Okay, can I have a motion?
Well, I'd make one, but I can't. So,
well, this would be essentially a consent action,
right?
Provision. So you could just say, "Are there any objections? If no objections, so ordered." So that's probably the easiest way to do on something like this.
Yeah,
we notified both applicants who did submit letters of interest that we would not be doing interviews tonight.
Okay. Are there any objections? Okay, hearing none, we will make that change to the agenda. Moving on. The second item is ordinance 2020-07-1064, repealing White Salmon Municipal Code 17.36. and adding new White Salmon Municipal Code 17.36 MHRP Mobile/Manufactured Home Residential Park District. A presentation to start.
Okay, I'll take that, Jason. So if you guys have read the whereases in the ordinance, it kind of explains the administration's position is that we don't feel that the current zoning is meeting the intent of the comp plan and to protect affordable housing or workforce housing, however you want to prefer it. So that's kind of led up to somewhat of the moratorium to correct this issue and some other issues. So there was some changes, designated to protect the mobile home park district as a mobile home district and not a hybrid residential district. Not that one cannot be accomplished. There's a way to do it, maybe potentially through a comprehensive plan where they're not sold off as individual lots, but maybe able to build like cottages or something like that. But they
do you mean a conditional use, Pat? You said comprehensive plan. Conditional use,
yeah, sorry. Where they can present different alternatives. The parcel would still remain one parcel. It would work more as a community organization, such as a mobile home park district. There are other options that if the property owner could show that the manufacturer or the keeping as a manufactured home zoning was not affordable, well, not really affordable, but not feasible or profitable, that they could present actually a zone change if they needed to do that as well. Other than that, the code just kind of clarifies the uses. One thing we did have to add is the city's old code did not provide anything for town tiny houses. This was a new law that I believe was just enacted last year. Is that right, Ken?
Yeah.
Yeah. That so cities cannot prevent tiny houses from coming in. So there are allowable use in there. We just stayed with the basically state law standards on square footage limitations as specified by state law for these types of issues. This ordinance has gone through a public hearing process and been reviewed by the Planning Commission, and which took comments from citizens at that time and did make some modifications to it. Those modifications have been implemented into this ordinance, and I'm more willing to answer any questions that you guys may have.
Okay. Should we start with a motion, or do we want to start with discussion?
Could we start with discussion?
Sure. Go ahead, Ashley.
So, Pat, you mentioned that tiny houses or tiny homes couldn't be blocked from the mobile home, manufactured home zone. So I was just curious. My understanding is that mobile homes are considered a type of tiny home, but my understanding is there's types of tiny homes that are not mobile. You know, there's types that are stick built and permanent on a foundation. Do we need any kind of language?
No. The RCW that we're referring to, they're talking about tiny homes that are built on a frame that are transportable.
Okay.
You're talking about cottage type stick built homes. There is a difference under state law. That's why, and this is a mobile home park zone. The city can't prevent them from coming in, but they can control what zoning they are allowed in. So obviously it makes sense that since they're transportable, that they go into a mobile home park district.
Okay. I was also reading through the minutes from the Planning Commission meeting, and I was trying to understand, based on the way the minutes were written, what Attorney Woodridge was saying about penciling out something from 17.36.140. With the concern that the mobile home park wouldn't be able to be operated profitably. And so I was curious, has that section already been removed? Reading through it, it wasn't clear to me what he was referring to.
Ken, I'll let you take that. She's referring to the protection language that was held up in court.
Yeah, that's constitutional limitation that you can't essentially make by ordinance make it impossible for somebody to have an economic use of their property. So it has built-in protection to make sure that if somebody can show that they've lost all economic use of their property by virtue of this designation, that we would have to provide some other means of qualifying. So I don't have that 140 in front of me. I can take a look at it.
You want me to read it, Ken?
No, I'm looking at it right now. This essentially gives, this was included because there was a state Supreme Court case that said, in essence, that any designation like this would require essentially this paragraph, because in that case, the city had this exception, and the court pointed to this exception to say that the city's ordinance was constitutional. So by virtue of that logic, we included the same section that the court indicated would be necessary for this kind of a designation to survive a constitutional challenge. That's why it's there.
Okay.
Joe?
That kind of leads into my question, is the feasibility and profitability, is there a threshold or guidance in that? Because I'm not really if you presented that juxtaposed to, if I develop this into apartment complexes, cottage complex, small tiny homes or something like that, like, is there a way that that's the current use is weighed against a possible use?
Yeah, it is weighed against the possible use. And if the current use, you know, is possible, and it doesn't prevent somebody from continuing it because it's just, there's no economic use of it, the court will say, you know, we're not going to make the city change it because you have a more profitable use in some other way. If the use is feasible and can be used, and the property can be used economically, which it has been, you know, historically, then it meets that constitutional threshold. Now, there may be other uses the landowner would qualify to convert it to under our ordinance. That's okay. They can do it because if it's permitted or conditional, you know, they have a process they can follow. The only thing that's constitutionally prescribed is our essentially making it financially useless, more or less.
Okay.
And that's not an issue here, but that section is making, that use exception is making sure that we have a process, essentially due process they can follow if they want to raise that argument. We've given them that opportunity.
So secondly, then, if I understand correctly, that if and when this passes, if somebody were to leave and then somebody new come in, does that exchange trigger the new code as far as an additional water and sewer hookup?
Well, that's a little different problem.
Maybe I can clarify that again. So is there a standard that, like, this, under this provision, like this old code, you can have this many units, now there's a new code with new density. So if someone leaves and someone comes back to fill that existing space, does that trigger the new?
Yeah, they would be subject to the new ordinance that's in effect when they, I mean, in other words, they wouldn't continue to be grandfathered typically if they acquired it.
So specifically then, if you have a recreational vehicle, like a trailer that's parked in the lot, and you have a sewer line hookup to like an RV hookup that's tied into the existing sewer, would they have to redo this? Would that trigger like a sewer or infrastructure?
Well, Pat can explain that better, but.
No, the only thing that's going to require that, Joe, is if they're failing or expanding. So for instance, let's say they have 10 lots and they come in and want to build 5 more lots. Obviously they're going to have to expand the system and improve it at that time for those additional lots, and they will be billed for those additional lots.
Or if they have a system that's failing and there's say sewer within a certain distance, then they would have to connect. That's just a regular thing.
David?
Sort of on the same theme, but reviewing the notes from the Planning Commission, I also noticed a bullet that said, Attorney Woodridge strongly suggested that administrative staff should have a meeting with the landowner to make that ordinance viable. So I was curious, have there been subsequent discussions with the landowner?
I've actually talked to Donna Rockwell this week, since virtually she's the only one going to be left. I've talked to Crumb Packer a lot as well. And Marla's met with Crumb. We actually, probably 3 to 4 weeks into the COVID stuff, we had a phone conference with Mr. Crumb Packer and discussed these changes. Like I said, I talked to Donna Rockwell this week, spent a significant amount of time with her on the phone going over this item by item, and she's fine with the modifications.
Thanks for that. One other more specific thing, I noticed crosswalking the two, this was brought up. In 17.36.160D, it references a city building permit. I think that should be a placement permit. It's a separate permit for manufactured home placement. The next section talks about building permits, and it's referencing actual new structures, I think. In 36.160, it's referencing just bringing in a new manufactured home. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I think the L&I permit is the placement permit. Isn't that right, Pat?
Hold on. So you're saying what, 1736, which one?
36.160 part B. It says state L&I industry permit and city building permit, but I noticed we have a city placement permit.
Yeah, if you read one, it talks about it says no manufactured home or mobile home park shall be moved into the city limits White Salmon without prior authorization of the city. A placement permit is issued prior to city building inspection of the HUD and Washington State L&I inspection tag. So that's the placement permit for the manufactured home. But B is saying, so if you're starting to alter of a manufactured home, like you're attaching to an awning or a building or an add-on to it, that portion you build has to have a building permit. Okay. So, and it's kind of complicated because if you set it up against it, you don't have to have an L&I permit. But if you hang it on the manufactured home, you have to have an L&I permit and a building permit both.
Gotcha.
That make more sense to you?
Oh, it's clear. Yeah. It's an addition to. It's not just simply bringing it in. You're adding something to it.
Right.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Yep.
I have a couple questions. First of all, the new code has a conditional use requirement for home occupation. And I just felt like that was a little vague. The old code says home occupation per definition in section 17.08.230. I was wondering if we could just add that when I first read home occupation, you need a conditional use to occupy the home.
So we're going to have to go in after we adopt this and modify chapter 17, which is the definition section. And all those numbers and letters are going to change. So that's why we kind of refer to it as vaguely. Then we'll come back and modify this to be more specific to that.
Got it. Could we, instead of saying home occupation, say home-based business or something like that? Or is that get into more?
Well, usually our code kind of uses home occupation throughout, and we would have to go change a lot of language.
I see. Okay. Good enough.
That's why we stuck with certain terms, so.
Yeah, I'd just like to see it called out a little more specifically, just because it says you need a conditional permit for home occupation. It seems vague. And then my other question was related to the, I believe it was Mr. Crumpacker's public comment in the public hearing, where they talked about the extra cost due to the water requirements. And I couldn't, by reading this, I couldn't really understand what the water requirements are and what the extra cost that would be added. So Pat,
I'm not really sure what he's getting at. I mean, in our conversation that me and Marla had with him, he's talking about, like if he was to rearrange it like he was planning, or being able to rearrange it like he was planning or whatever, that those infrastructure costs to meet city's current standards, which really has nothing to do with this, or the rising cost of why they can't build something. Well, we have state law requirements to say we have to follow certain standards. Our standards are not unreasonable. It's just a cost any developer is going to have to make, whether it's a subdivision or a short plat. You know, it happens.
So does each mobile home have to have its own water and sewer hookup, or is there one? I didn't really understand that, and it's probably
it depends. There's now, we'll just use White Salmon as an example. They have one bulk meter that serves all of them. We bill them per lot for ADUs, because that's how our billing code set up.
I see.
Every accessory dwelling unit pays a base fee. Water usage, however they decide to bill for that, the property owner bills for that, that's up to them. Now, there are mobile home parks throughout Washington State that have individual meters. That's the way they've set them up. And because they, you know, the property owner didn't want to cover those expenses and have individual sewer systems. So in some cases, they're private, and in other cases, they're turned over to the local municipality through easement right-of-ways to maintain and become part of public property. It just depends on how the developer wants to set it up.
So Jason, I think this refers to the earlier discussion. Right now, you know, they are billed on one meter, and they have like one hookup with, and then it feeds all the different things. And I think, I can't remember who asked it, but if they wanted to reconfigure their property or add new mobile homes, then they might have to add new water and sewer hookups. So I think that's where Mr. Crumpacker is talking about, is that those costs for redeveloping the property, he feels maybe are a little high.
I see. And so we're not prescribing how they meter their water or how they sell their water essentially to their residents.
Their existing customers know, but in the future, if they were to redevelop, then the code I believe does have some requirements.
Yeah, I think maybe this will make some clarity, Jason, on water quality. So even at your house, once you pass the meter, the water line is your private water line. I think everyone pretty much understands that.
Yeah.
But the water in that system, even though you're buying it, under the Federal Drinking Water Act, the water purveyor is still responsible for the quality of that water to the last faucet on your property. So we're still responsible, even though it's gone through that meter, we still are responsible for the quality of that water. And how we ensure that is how they construct their infrastructure. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's actually, I've never agreed with that law, but it is the law, you know, that's how it is. There's other ways to deal with it, but, you know, part of our job is to make sure, you know, in drinking water and wastewater, we're dealing with public health issues. We want to make sure that regardless behind the meter, that water customer, whether they're renting from somebody or not, is getting quality water and wastewater service.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that seems clear enough to me. Any other questions on this ordinance?
I do. I have another.
Okay, go ahead, Ashley.
So two other things I was looking at. One is the under additional requirements, D, where it's talking about any attached addition or attached accessory building shall be compatible.
What section exactly?
That's 17.36.160.
Okay.
Additional requirements. And it's talking about how any attached accessory buildings shall be compatible with the design, color, and exterior covering, including roofing to the manufacturer of modular home.
So if you're adding a garage, we want it to match the house.
Okay. Does that need to be a little bit more specific? Does the language need to be a little bit more specific?
Well, we don't know what color the house is going to be or what kind of roofing they're going to have. So,
but the just saying compatible.
Compatible means if you've got a pretty much you cannot buy a manufactured home now that's tin sided. It just they don't do that anymore. It's all composition roof. Most of it's T111 siding or some type form of lap siding. Is that if you're building something, we want you to match the existing structure. If you're attaching it to your house, it needs to look like it belongs to the existing structure is what we're getting at.
Ashley, this language is similar to language that's used in the accessory dwelling conditional use permit section of our code. Accessory dwelling units have to be compatible with the design color and exterior, you know, compatible with the existing residence when you're building a new ADU.
Okay.
So it's similar language that we've used in our code elsewhere.
Okay. I was also going through and I was trying to find the section that I read earlier that's talking about the property owner's responsibility to provide storage units on each lot. And I question that mandating that. It looks like that came up in the discussion with the planning commissioners as well. And that the reason was mainly just so that there's
space. You have to read the section.
Yeah, I need to find it. Let's see.
It's section 1736040B, number 5. Each site shall be equipped with a storage shed, not less than 60 square feet of storage space.
Yeah. Now, this only applies if somebody's building something new. You understand that?
Oh, I didn't. No.
Yeah, this doesn't mean any trailer park right now, as it's built, is grandfathered in. If they're expanding, they have to do that. And trailer park, you know, people have kids, everything else. There needs to be, and they're living in very small square footage. Mm-hmm. There needs to be sheds instead of that stuff thrown all over the yard, everything that keeps everything organized, locked up, and safe. That's a common practice in trailer parks.
Okay. And so the way this is written, it's open-ended whether the owner of the mobile park home or mobile home park could require that of their tenants or versus them being required to provide that themselves.
For the owner?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let me read this.
She's asking, Pat, is it a requirement, the way it's written, if a mobile homeowner, let's say, is developing a new park, strips everything out and starts all over, the way it's written is it's not clear whether the mobile home park owner has to provide the storage units or the owner of the manufactured home that's being moved in has to provide the storage unit.
That depends on how the property owner or the owner of the trailer park decides they want to do it. Do they want to provide them or do they want to require it of their tenants? We're not trying to get into micromanaging of how they manage their business. We're just saying they have to have one.
All right. Thank you.
David?
Yeah, I guess backing up, I had a process question, and maybe this is specifically for Ken. Is it the prerogative of the city council whether there are one or two readings of this, and is there any guidance whether it'd be prudent to have two when you're doing something like a wholesale chapter swap?
Well, the only requirement for a change of the zoning code is a public hearing, and you've had that. I think you've actually had one at the planning commission level, and I think the council had one as well. Is that true or not?
Well, the council had a workshop session where I think public comment was allowed generally at that time. And then the city council referred the matter to the planning commission for a public hearing in which both the city council and the planning commission participated in.
Right. Okay. You've had a public hearing. I think the problem, you can have as many as you want. You can only, there's a minimum, but there's not a maximum. So it really is up to the council how much public input you're wanting after you've had that required meeting. I think there is an issue here on the moratorium expiring as far as, you know, if it expires, somebody could then after the expiration, they could submit a land use application before you would have another public hearing, and they'd be vested into the ordinance in its old form, you know, the existing form. So it's probably not desirable to have that happen. So I don't think you have it on your agenda extending the moratorium. So I think it's kind of a do or die proposition at this point for this particular ordinance, you know, without running the risk of somebody having a vested application after the moratorium expires. So, but as far as prudence, it's really, after the required public hearing, some councils do multiple ones, most of them don't, you know.
So Ken, I also think that Jason was asking, does the city council need to have one or two readings of the ordinance? This is the first reading at the council level.
No, there's nothing in the RCWs about multiple readings. The only thing that ever appears in the RCWs that's a pre-adoption requirement is the public hearing for certain types of ordinances. Actually, a very small percentage of ordinances require a public hearing, but a change to the land use development code does require a public hearing. You've complied with that, so it's really up to you guys whether you want to move forward with it or not.
When does the moratorium expire? Is that on 15th, the 15th? I think.
Yes, July 15th.
Yeah. And that's the date of our next meeting.
Yes.
That's right.
Would it be necessary to extend, since there's an overlap there?
I don't know if there is an overlap. That's a good question, whether it expires on the 15th or whether the 15th is the day that a new application could be filed. I don't know offhand, quite honestly. It's prudent not to have a gap. If there's something council wants reworked on the ordinance, then I'd say, yeah, maybe we should even consider a special meeting. But, I guess the staff would like, at this point, we'd either like to have it adopted or rejected, or if there's specific instructions from council about changes, great, but I guess that's kind of where I'm.
Hey, where I am.
Yeah,
got a question for you. So, after adoption, how many days does it take for the orders to become effective?
That's also a problem. It's five days after publication.
After publication, and it will publish on July 8th.
Apply for a land use decision within those 7 days or 5 days, they would fall and submit an application. They would be vested under the old rules.
You're right. Yes. So this is really your opportunity. If you don't do it now, then there's certainly a risk that somebody will file an application before we could adopt another version of this.
Is it too late to add to our agenda for today to extend just the rezoning portion of our moratorium?
Yeah, no, you'd have to have a public hearing for extending the moratorium.
Okay.
And that has to be published in the paper, right, Jan?
Yes.
Yeah.
You would need to have a special meeting.
Yeah.
Soon you'd have to have.
Yeah. I mean, we could, you wouldn't be able to have a special meeting until after July 8th, because that is the next publication date. And having a special meeting 2 days after a publication date, you could legally do it, but that's probably contrary to noticing the public that you're going to have this public hearing. And so then you're running clear into the next week prior to the council meeting.
My concern is just that we are resurrecting this topic after several months of not discussing it, and we didn't have any public comment. We didn't receive any public comment today. And so I'm definitely leaning towards having a second reading.
Ashley, I'm not trying to talk you out of anything. Whatever you guys decide to do is up to you totally. But Donna said she was, after I spoke with her, she was content and did not plan on submitting public comment. So, we sent her a letter about public comment and she's decided not to do that. And I believe Mr. Crumpacker has also had that opportunity and chose not to do that. And they are the two primary property owners who are affected by this ordinance.
And so Ashley, we did immediately once the ordinance was completed, we emailed the two property owners that and specified that they, even though there wasn't a public hearing, at that time, the mayor Marla had said that if they submitted public comment under the public comment section, we would take it. We also, noticed that in our agenda, and when we posted the ordinance in both English and Spanish, we did a news release that information was available on our website. And again, at that time, in the news information, noted that there was no public hearing, however, we would take public comment. And so I think, I'm not for sure what extending the time period's going to allow related to public comment. Pat and I had this discussion earlier today. We did hold a public hearing and we heard from quite a few people at that meeting. Yes. If you remember, it was a lot of people came and spoke. Maybe not necessarily specifically to the code itself, but to the issues of being evicted out of a mobile home park. And we heard from Mr. Crumpacker at that time.
So Ken, if we were to pass this today, in order to come back later and make further changes to reopen it, that would require another public meeting.
Public hearing.
Public hearing. Thank you.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I personally don't think that any of the changes in this new code are so outlandish or, I think the reason that we didn't get public comment is because I think it's a pretty, from what I can tell, pretty well written and pretty, the changes are fairly modest.
Yeah, I would say the biggest change is limiting stick-built houses or those options outright, which would in turn, and that's what kind of concerned the administration, is so basically you could take a mobile home park district and turn it into a hybrid R1 subdivision, and that which is totally incompatible with the zoning and the intent of the zoning
and the comp plan. Right.
And I think it's important to recognize that under law, our ordinances are supposed to reflect our comp plan. And it's here again, the administration's position that this is not doing that. This is what changed why the mayor felt it was necessary to go into a moratorium to change these things so that we were in compliance with the comp plan.
Actually, I do have one other question. Under 17.36.030, conditional uses. Now, why are nursery schools and family child daycare centers included? I recognize the need for...
under conditional uses?
Conditionally.
Under conditional uses. So I recognize that the need for more nursery schools and child daycare centers. However, if that was put into one of those spaces as a conditional use, that would remove livable space.
Maybe not. They're home. It would oftentimes those are home occupations where the resident of the facility lives there, and then during the day they have a nursery or a child care business.
I had a different question on that, and I'll explain it to you, Ashley. If somebody asked me why it was a conditional use to begin with, why wasn't it a permitted use? Well, under a conditional use, it's more scrutiny review. It's not saying that they can't do it, but particularly with daycare centers and these type of facilities, they have to comply with DOH requirements. So that's why we throw it under conditional use, so it kicks that process in and that more intense review to make sure that we're communicating with the health department and seeing their requirements and their certificates that they have authorized and permitted this use if the city sees fit to allow the conditional use. Does that make
sense? And we might also want at that point scrutinize its proximity to things like gun shops and marijuana stores and those kinds of things that you'd want to kind of make sure was not too in too close a proximity.
And just as an FYI, there are some types of daycare centers that particularly the ones that are in-home daycare centers that are the small ones, the city cannot prevent those. Now you can review and you can address some parking issues and things like that, but by state law, you cannot prevent them from happening in homes. And so we ran into that, learned that very quickly down in Bingen. So they're usually the small in-home care centers. They're not the full-blown daycare center where you have all kinds of teaching and stuff going on.
David, you had a comment?
I was just gonna say, I believe that's a potential conditional use in all of our residential zones.
That's correct.
Yes.
Well, and the intent for, daycare is really essential to workforce housing, and that's really kind of the intent of this zoning as well. These are working class people that are looking for their daycare centers and places.
Okay. Yeah, my concern was less about it happening within a home and more about it taking the place of a home. So my last question on the subject is, should that be included under A, home occupations?
So let me put it this way. So that's the point of a conditional use. They're going to have to go through the conditional use process. And, depending on the level, it could end up at the the Planning Commission's level. But we're not going to allow them to displace housing or a bunch of housing to put a daycare center in. That's not going to happen. That's why it's a conditional use process. Now, you would be more concerned about that if it was a permitted outright use. Mm-hmm. They could do that. You see what I'm getting at?
Yes.
So, Ashley, the difference between a home occupation and a nursery school or family daycare center, typically a home occupation, you would never know that the person that lives in that home is doing a business there. It's typically like bookkeeping. Maybe they're making a craft in a room and they ship it out. But typically home occupations do not have customers. There's no signage associated with it. it is basically invisible in a house. Somebody who's working from their home, like Ken, he could decide he doesn't want to, and he may have done this at one point, doesn't want an office, and he's just, you know, he works out of his home, and then maybe when he needs a meeting space, he goes down to Starbucks or something. So that's, home occupation is invisible to the outside person stopping by. They would never know you had a business going on in there.
Mm.
Yeah.
And by tax laws, I don't think it can be bigger than like a quarter of your home or something. There's a size limitation. The IRS monitors home occupations.
So it's, Jason, it sounds like you were saying you're comfortable with moving forward without a second reading. Is David and Joe, is that how you're feeling as well?
That's straw polling.
Oh.
No, they can do that. It's open.
Okay. So, well, that's kind of asking for a vote.
No, it just says that she's just asking, are they comfortable about going to a vote at this meeting? It doesn't say whether they're voting yes or no.
Okay, I misunderstood what she was asking.
Stay out of the council's business, Pat. Let them do what they're going to do.
I'll phrase it this way. My line of questioning regarding, you know, first and second reading was pretty much process-based. I wasn't suggesting one way or the other, for my own education. And reflecting back to January and the emergency declaration, for me, that was the most emergent issue, was the potential for this to be converted to stick-built homes. And so I think passing an ordinance and making this change while the moratorium's in place would be a good outcome.
I feel procedurally we've crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's, and the property owners have been given their chance and expressed their views. And I feel that that process has been completed. So I'm comfortable going forward.
Will you make a motion then?
Make that motion.
Joe, are you saying that you're going to use the motion that's in the agenda memo?
Yes.
You want me to read it?
I can read it. Yes. Can you read it for me?
Yeah, sure. It's a motion to adopt ordinance 2020-07-1064, repealing White Salmon Municipal Code 17.36 MHR Mobile Home Residential District, adding new chapter 17.36 MHRP Mobile/Manufactured Home Residential Park District, and providing for severability and an effective date upon first reading, and finding that adoption of this ordinance is exempt from SEPA review per RCW 43.21C.450 (1), in that the amendments to the development regulations are required to ensure consistency with the city's adopted comprehensive plan, in that it was previously subjected to SEPA review and the impacts of the proposed regulation were specifically addressed in that review.
Thank you. Make that motion.
I'll second that.
Joe Turkowitz made the motion. Ashley Post seconded. Jen, will you call for a vote?
So a procedural issue, Ken. Does Jason vote?
He can, but the chair's not required to vote. You do have a quorum without the chair's vote, but it's really up to him. He can or he can refrain. It's really up to the chairman.
I'd like to vote.
Okay. You're welcome to. Then generally after the roll call goes through, then you would say chair votes aye or nay, whichever.
I see.
Okay. David Lindley?
Aye.
Ashley Post?
Aye.
Joe Turkowitz?
Aye.
And the chair votes aye.
Motion
well
carries.
Done. I got you guys trained so well. I didn't even have to kick you, Jason.
I think the shock collar is broken or something. All right, moving on. I gotta scroll through. That was a long one.
Yeah.
I think we're
at the Spoke Bike Park.
Yeah, Spoke Bike Park Improvements and Non-Exclusive License and Indemnity Agreement. Presentation, is that you, Pat?
Yeah, I'm trying to, I got it open up here. So this is basically with some modifications what they signed last time on a maintenance agreement. This was kind of I'll let Ken explain that they're really not official organization and the parameters of that legality. Do you want to join in there for a minute, Ken?
Well, it's just it doesn't have much in the way of teeth since this is not an official either a not-for-profit or some sort of registered association. So, you know, if something happened and we needed to turn to them, there's really nobody to turn to. It's aspirational is really what it is. It's asking them to perform certain tasks as far as this property is concerned and their commitment to do so. It also makes sure we've got on the record that we may have to revoke this right at some point in time, particularly as to any portion that the city needs for its infrastructure improvements. So it's not something from a lawyer's perspective ideal, because this group is not official, but it does sort of reflect a spirit of the community, sort of aspirational agreement.
With that said, Scott has been involved in this since the beginning, and he's and his group have always met every condition that we've ever asked, and I think that's very admirable that he's done that. Other than that, the one thing that we wanted to really reiterate, which before it was in there but not as clear as we would like it, is to reiterate and make sure that they understand that there has been for 20 some years now a future plan for a portion of that park that has to do with stormwater, and that's going to become even more relevant now that we're going to exceed a population of 2,500, which is going to put us under the Stormwater Act, which means we're going to have to start looking at getting stormwater discharge permits, which are going to take 5 to 10 years backlog now, Ken, so just so you're aware. But we're going to have to start looking at ways of treating our stormwater through retention basins. So that site in a 20-year plan is recognized as a site that we're going to need to do that out. And there's a reason why that site was selected, because stormwater is gravity fed and it comes out at that site or close to that site now. It would be an easy solution and fix. That doesn't mean that they can't use the rest of the area and continue to use it as a bike park, but it's something that we wanted to reiterate. They were aware of this to begin with, that may happen at some time. I don't see this happening anytime in the immediate future, but at some time it will happen.
Hey, Pat, I did have a red line that didn't get included in this, and that's in the second, whereas I said in particular, the location of a stormwater facility on the property, and I didn't see that red line included.
Well, it talks about stormwater facilities in here on the property.
Where?
I'd have to go through the, we can read it again and maybe.
Okay, well, let's just make sure that maybe the council can, if you accept it, include it subject to final legal review, and then that way that language, I wanted to have that language in there because it really puts everybody on notice that there is an intended use for that property at some point in the future.
It does say the city has future essential infrastructure plans for said property or a portion thereof. Is that?
I know, but I was very specific about the stormwater facility.
Yeah, I remember that. I don't know. I remember us having that in there. I don't know how I.
Anticipated future stormwater needs. It's included in the explanation of the issue,
mm-hmm.
but not in the agreement.
Oh, okay. Well, it should have been. And we can make that, we can include that. That draft is somewhere in Pat's inbox. So, and that's really the only change I made to speak of. Just.
Yeah, I took what was sent to me.
Yeah, Pat, you forwarded her the wrong one.
No, I don't. I must have erased it or something by accident. So.
So Pat, if let's say this moves forward and it's a smashing success in the city of White Salmon, people love it, which looks pretty great. Is there a possibility that we could, if we did have stormwater needs, that we could place some place that stormwater or treat that stormwater somewhere else?
Well, there's always way to do that, Jason, but it's the expense. And I guess that would be something that you would want to cross, or the future councilors may want to cross at that time. I mean, you guys are the legislative body. You can decide, no, we don't want to get rid of the park, or we do want to get rid of the park. Our goal is to make everyone aware that there is this intent in the future. And that was in the prior council, when they approved this, where was really concerned about that intent, saying that's why they kind of threw up their hands and saying, we're not calling it a park. We're not recognizing it as a city park. If you want to go use the public property, go use the public property. But here's the conditions. That was kind of more the intent back then. This kind of clears it up a little bit more, but we're still not taking it as it's a city maintained park. It's just a city public, it's just public property. And like any public property, the public has a right to use it. And this group is asking to use it in a certain way. The city council is agreeing to allow that to be used in a city way. It makes it very clear that they can't prevent other people from using it because it is public property.
So Jason, this property has been identified for stormwater for a long time, even before mm-hmm. Pat came here.
Yes.
It makes sense. I mean, based on its location, right. I understand. Right. Mm-hmm.
Can I interject? So Pat and Jan, I just sent that red line version to you guys. There was one other change too. And in the preamble, instead of calling it a community volunteer group, I called it a community association. And that's an important difference because if they're in a community association, they would qualify potentially for the 3-to-1 volunteer statute 35.21.278, which allows the city to use some funds as long as we get a 3-to-1 benefit from the volunteer contribution. We can expend funds up to $25,000 for this group for their projects, provided we get the 3-to-1 financial benefit from it. So that's only available if we contract with a community association providing services in our area. So that's why I changed that to community association, because it does have that collateral benefit.
I like that.
Yeah. And just FYI, Scott is not asking for city funds at all on this. I believe he's already raised over $28,000 for the project. And he was adamant about that, if you remember, when he came before the city council before, that he is not asking for city funds. He's just asking for the use of the property to be used for a bike park that is open to the public.
But if you wanted to improve it in some other way that the city would want to do, that would necessarily be something he would want to do. I don't know, a restroom facility or something down there. Yeah. We could contribute money for it as long as they use mostly volunteer labor for the work. It's an easy change, and you have that side benefit.
I like it.
Question. So Jan and Pat, the identifying that spot for stormwater treatment, that was part of a study that was done, did you say 20 or so years ago?
Well, it's been a little less than 20 years ago, but part of it was looking at the size of white salmon and how large of a piece of property. I mean, basically,
it's a stormwater plan.
It's like a bioswale area. So water goes in there, it percolates into the ground, it's cleaned, it goes into surface water drainage, and then eventually ends up into the Columbia River. But before it gets into the Columbia River, the state has guidelines about how that's all to work. And so, again, given topography, it was identified as a site that was large enough to handle the city of white salmon and potentially the growth area around white salmon's stormwater.
The other site was in the PUD pole yard, which the PUD is not going to give up their pole yard for a stormwater basin for the city. To answer Jason's question, there may be an area upstream that we could do this, but you know, the challenging thing is anytime we're working that close to a water, it becomes really expensive really quick. This site's a little bit farther off from the water. So basically at the end of, you know, when you pull down in the Washington Street Trailer Park and that makes the bend there, off to the right, there's a stormwater that comes out now, drops into a ditch and drops over and runs down into the stream. There's no treatment on it. Whether that area could be used as somewhat of a level of retention, yeah, it could be, but I can't answer Jason with, is it sufficient enough to do any true filtering based on the location? That would take a engineer to determine. And
yeah,
you know, and that's great, but I think we're jumping way ahead. You know, we're right. Probably still looking at 15, 20 years before any of this happens.
So, yeah, do we own that other area?
Yeah. Yeah, it's inside the bike park area.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Is there any way that that I could get my hands on that that study? I'm just curious to take a look at it.
We can try to locate it. I don't know if it's scanned electronically, and then maybe when the rest of staff comes.
I've got new copies coming right now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So when we have it electronically, we can send it to you.
Do you want to just see the map, or do you want the whole document? Because it's 400 pages. So. I don't know if you want to read that.
I might be curious to look at parts of it.
Okay. All right.
Any more discussion? David?
Yeah, I guess I had a question about, we now have these two agreements and understanding there's not a lot of teeth, but this new non-exclusive license and indemnity agreement, and then there's the trail maintenance agreement dating back to 2012.
This will replace that.
Really?
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of language in that isn't in this indemnity agreement. I guess my question was, why aren't the two married, or why doesn't this new one reference the old one? Because there's like specific call-outs in regards to maintenance associated with potential erosion and various things like that.
I didn't have the impression, Pat, that this would replace that. I had the feeling that that one would
I agree with David that
this does things different than the trail maintenance agreement.
Yeah.
We still want them to meet certain standards for maintenance. This really doesn't talk about the standards for maintenance. It just basically talks about, you know, their tenure there and under what circumstances they're allowed to stay and, you know, and how we would potentially have to ask them to leave. Different different issues. And so to me, it's not really a merger of the two documents. They could stand alone separately.
Yes, and the mayor asked me about like garbage and some other things. And if you look at that in the original maintenance agreement, that is part of the club's job, is to help, you know, keep the site clean. Staff-wise, we, and with the mayor, we've talked about maybe making sure there's a garbage can down there, maybe getting one of the doggy bag poles down there with some signage so that when people do take their dogs down there, that they will, you know, we have those doggy bags available to pick up dog poo so that it's not all over the place.
Let me ask. So, Dave, are you worried about erosion during construction?
No, I think that the revision to the CEPA totally covered that. I guess just looking at the trail maintenance agreement, I think there are some subjects that are covered that are very different than this indemnity agreement. You can tell the trail maintenance agreement kind of tried to do both, because it talks about conflict resolution and, you know, reasons.
Well, that's why I kind of got rid of it, because it was, right. You know, back when this all started, there was a conflict with the gun club.
Sure.
And the bike park going in there. So we were trying to peacefully work those out. So.
Sure. There are things, you know, certainly calls out removal of litter. It talks about inspecting, cleaning, repairing water bars, drain discs, mud holes, etc. So I guess I was wondering, is there a way to nest the trail maintenance agreement within Southern so that it's incorporated by reference but subordinate to, or I would defer to others, but it seems like there are sections of that are still relevant.
I guess if Kevin thinks it, or Ken thinks it would be easier just to leave them separate, we could put a statement in here that this is in conjunction with the original agreement.
Yeah, I mean, there might be some overlap. I don't think there's conflict, but there may be some overlap. So I don't see any harm in just adding a provision that would say this agreement reaffirms the terms of the maintenance agreement.
Yeah. And then we could attach it. Does that work for everybody?
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good point, David. Thanks for pointing that out.
Yeah. Thanks, Dave. So, because we need to get this moving. For Scott's really anxious to go, and I don't blame him. So,
could we pass it with that amendment?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. There's no reason why. I mean, we can do that administratively. Make that modification. Just referencing probably where it talks about the IMBA maintenance, where it says licensee agrees all trails constructed and maintained. We could just add
and attorney's red line changes.
Yeah, my changes, and also adding that line referencing the maintenance agreement.
Oh, okay. Referencing the whole maintenance agreement.
Yeah, right. just by incorporation by reference.
Yeah, I like it. Should we wait for Ashley's internet cut out? So she's...
Yeah, she's coming back right now. She's
back.
There she is.
Good timing.
Okay.
All right, can we get a motion?
I'll make a motion. Motion to authorize improvements to be made to the Spoke Bike Park by White Salmon Spoke Club, and to authorize the mayor to sign non-exclusive license and indemnity agreement with White Salmon Spoke Club, incorporating attorney red lines and incorporation by reference of the trail agreement.
Beautiful.
Are you a second?
Second.
All right. Moved by David Lindley, seconded by Joe Turkowitz. Jan, will you take a roll? Further discussion? All right, hearing none, Jan, will you take a vote?
David Lindley?
Aye.
Ashley Post? You're muted.
Aye.
Thank you. Joe Turkowitz?
Aye.
And the chair votes aye.
Motion carries.
All right, moving on. Hold on, I gotta stop the piano player in my house for a second.
Can you please not play?
Sorry about that. All right, next agenda item. Moving through. Is the Rhine Garden Park restroom remodel small works roster bid presentation and discussion.
So that's me. Let me bring up my notes that I sent to you earlier.
Oh, so, that's right. I saw that.
Yes. So the city received only one bid. It was from an out-of-town contractor from Walla Walla, which was approximately $29,000 over the engineer's estimate. The bidder was notified that we would not be accepting their bid and we would be rebidding the project. And the contractor clearly he understood. He actually sent us the details on his bid, and I'll be sharing that information with Pat. We will be rebidding this project and attempting to get a local contractor to bid on the project. And then I just wanted to make this formal announcement. So there's no action item at this time. Hopefully we'll have something before you at the next meeting so we can get this moved up. This contractor did tell me that even if he had won the contract, he would not have been able to do the work until September, because he's booked that far out. So that might be something we'll need to discuss with local contractors, but maybe our local contractors. We had, this contractor also did not travel and look at the project. And so I know we had a couple of contractors look at it because Public Works told me about that. So I know that MTEC, the contractor that did the work here at the City Hall, had been interested in it. And we had a contractor from Hood River specifically submit his small works roster application because I thought he was going to bid on it. And sometimes days just get away from people, particularly in the world we live in right now. People forget what day it is. So it's possible these contractors just missed the deadline. So hopefully we will be able to take a look at it. Pat and I will take a look at it. We'll talk to our engineer and we'll get information back out to some of our local contractors and see if we can't get them to bid on it.
Okay, I had one question. I thought we were gonna discuss, or I thought we were gonna move forward with a plan that did not include heat in the bathroom.
Well, the committee, so it includes both. So we asked for a quote without the heating and with the heating.
Got it. Okay.
The community development committee, before things for parks kind of got moved out of there and more into the operations group, is that there are quite a few people who would like that restroom open year round, because even in the winter time, people use the park, and without heating in there, we cannot have the restroom open in the winter time because the pipes will freeze.
Good enough. Okay.
I think Joe has a question.
Oh, Joe. Yeah, go ahead.
Were those the plans that the contractors had to bid off of?
Yes, they are.
Can I make a couple comments on them?
Maybe you could call Pat and make those comments directly to him.
Okay.
And not during the council meeting.
Sure.
I wasn't the engineer. But yeah. I'll be more glad to talk with you about them.
Sounds good.
Okay.
I have a question as well.
Go ahead.
So, Jan, another conversation that we'd been having in committee was about having automatic locks.
That's part of the bid.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Awesome. Are we okay to move on?
I'm done.
Crestline payment number 4 and USDA reimbursement request number 4.
Yes, so That's pretty straightforward. Let me find it in my packet. So we have a Crestline payment in the amount of $211,674.08, and a USDA reimbursement request number four in the amount of $246,303.61. And just as a reminder, the reason there are differences in those is because the USDA reimbursement request includes our engineering construction costs, so our engineers' costs are in there. And in this case, part of the Crestline payment is related to a stormwater pipe that was put in as part of this project, and those funds come from the street fund and not the USDA loan.
I see.
And so we're recommending the council authorize the Crestline payment and the USDA reimbursement request.
Okay, discussion? Hearing none, could we have a motion?
I'll make the motion to approve Crestline construction payment number four in the amount of $211,674.08. And USDA reimbursement request number four in the amount of $246,303.61.
We have a second?
Second.
All right, moved by Ashley Post, seconded by Joe Turkowitz. Jan, will you take a vote?
David Lindley?
Aye.
Ashley Post?
Aye.
Joe Turkowitz?
Aye.
Jason?
Aye. Chair votes aye.
Motion doesn't carries. Really matter.
All right. Sorry. I believe the next one is the Innovative Composites Engineering Sewer Overage Billing Request Presentation and Discussion. Jan?
So as you remember at your last meeting, I had presented a standard leak adjustment, but the council has to vote on all of those that are over $500. And so that was treated, their original request was treated per our code. Our code is very specific about how those leak adjustments are made. They do not, the code does not address the fact that for businesses are charged differently for sewer than residential customers. Residential customers, you get a flat rate per month for sewer, period. Businesses are charged a flat rate, and then they're charged, and that accounts for a certain amount of ERUs, basically 8,500 gallons, and then anything over that is charged as overage. And so the code does not address a leak whereby the water, which is used to account for the cost for sewer overages, goes into the ground and is not going into the sewer system. And so at the last meeting, you approved an adjustment to their utility billing of $2,901.36. The sewer reduction was $1,350. Their original overage charges were $2,880. They requested, they sent an email asking for an additional reduction on the sewer overages. They used an average of the last two billing cycles where we actually metered and came up with a calculation of $391. But their calculation of that $391 includes the base fee, which cannot be reduced. And so I provided you a couple of options. I feel that if you're going to reduce the sewer overage additionally, we should use the amount that we should use the gallons of water that was originally used to calculate the original reduction. So it would actually result in a higher reduction than they're asking for. So. It's up to you guys how you want to handle this. They're asking for so they're asking for a reduction, an additional reduction of to get it down to $333,000. And so I'm just trying to calculate this.
They're asking for $1,197, right?
Yes.
And then and you're suggesting, you're recommending a reduction of actually $1,350.
Yes. And so it's up to you. I mean, I brought this to you because I have no authority to provide this this additional reduction. It is in the county's, I mean, in the city council's purview. Per code, I'm not for sure you have the authority to do. I mean, the council can make any decision they want, but by code, this is not addressed.
Well, I think Jan's point here is the water break was outside. This was not a typical residential house with a leaking toilet or leaking sink that was running water down the sewer system, which is really the intent of how our code is written on. So, you know, whatever, like, I think that's the point she's trying to make. So whatever you guys decide is fine with the administration side of it.
And we did touch on this briefly at the last meeting, I recall, and we kind of were all talking about the same situation prior to this, that it didn't actually enter the sewer and tax the sewer system.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, so I guess now the question is just, you know, if we are to authorize a reduction in sewer charges, is it the $1,350 that we calculated based on the overage of water that was used. And I would be supportive of that.
I'll make that motion.
The motion to authorize
clerk treasurer to reduce sewage overage charges on the May 29th, 2020 utility bill by an additional amount of $1,350.
All right, do I have a second?
Second that.
Okay. Moved by Joe Turkowitz, seconded by David Lindley. Any more discussion? Jan, will you take a vote?
David Lindley.
Aye.
Ashley Post.
Aye.
Joe Turkowitz.
Aye.
Chair votes aye.
Motion carries.
Leak adjustment Barbara Bailey.
Those are under the consent agenda.
Oh, sorry. So are we on to the consent agenda now?
Yes.
All right.
So this is where Jason, if a council member wishes to pull an item from the consent agenda, they make that request now and it can be considered separately. Or you would entertain a motion to approve the consent agenda as presented.
I see.
I have a question. Without pulling an item from the consent agenda to consider separately, could I ask a question about one of the items, or is it necessary to pull it?
You can pull it prior to the motion to adopt the consent agenda as presented. And then if your question's not satisfactorily answered, you can ask that it be pulled for a council vote. It's a council vote that you'd be pulling it for, in case you'd be concerned that item might be considered separately.
So ask the question.
Go ahead. Can't she ask a question about it without pulling it?
Okay.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, that's what she was asking.
So in regard to the purchase of face masks, those face masks have already been ordered. Did I read that correctly?
Yes, they have been.
Okay. And that that purchase was part of the mayor's emergency declaration.
Yes, she felt that it was important to under her, she or asked me to go ahead and order these under her authority, under the emergency declaration. It is being covered by the CARES funding. She is very adamant about encouraging people to follow the governor's mandate to wear face masks. And she feels that it is critical that in helping get that mandate carried out by providing face masks to our citizens.
And they're being passed out via the farmer's market.
Yes, I'm going to update you a little bit under the department head updates in a minute.
Okay. Yeah, when I first saw that as part of our agenda, my first thought was that's a lot of, even though it's being reimbursed, that's a lot of money to spend for every person in our city to receive a mask when probably the majority of people already own them. And even our website shows that there's places where you can get them for free if cost is an issue. But then I realized that the purchase had already been made. So I don't think there's any reason.
Well, remember, we have a population of well over 2,500 in this town.
Yeah.
And so the majority of our community is not low income. Mm-hmm. I think the idea is by providing them free, it reinforces and re-encourages people to use them. David and I will be talking about something later under department heads and council meeting updates. She feels very strongly about this. And so feels that it's really important. And if you remember, I think at the last two council meetings, she had expressed that we were working on this. Mm-hmm. And again, $2.25 per mask is very inexpensive. There's a group over in Hood Rivers that is making masks, and they cost a lot more than $2.25 a mask. These are also made in the United States.
That's good.
And so, I think over time, people are going to want more than one mask. You're going to want two or three masks just because, you don't want to, some people don't do laundry every day. They don't have kids.
Any more discussion? All right. Can I have a motion to adopt consent agenda and I assume vouchers?
In the amount of $273,980.56.
I'll make the motion to pass the consent agenda in the amount that Jan stated.
Can I get a second?
Second.
All right. Moved by Ashley Post, seconded by Joe Turkowitz. Jan, can you take a roll call vote?
David Lindley.
Aye.
Ashley Post.
Aye.
Joe Turkowitz.
Aye.
Jason Hartman.
Aye.
Motion carries.
All right. Department heads. Jan, why don't we start with you?
Okay, so to talk about the city is going to start hosting a table at Farmer's Market, and a couple of things are going to happen at that, a number of things, giving out the free face masks once they come in. They should have shipped today, so I'm hoping, crossing my fingers because they're coming in from California, that they'll be here by next Tuesday. David Lindley also reached out to me, and he has some access to some other free masks. So I'm hoping to get some size small for children because we didn't order those sizes. And then also maybe some adult sizes, because I'm sure we will get people who don't live in the city limits of White Salmon coming to the table asking for free masks. And then we would be able to provide those that he's provided me the information from to those out-of-city residents. The other thing that we have had, not a lot, but a few complaints about is because City Hall is available, people can't come in and get their blue recycling bags. I don't know what happens to people's blue recycling bags, but they seem to disappear, I guess, for certain citizens. We will advertise that they can come on Tuesday afternoons and pick up free recycling bags. The third thing is the Hood River Pool is open in limited capacity. I have spoken with them, and they are welcoming city residents. And so this year, again, we will provide, and it was included in our budget, we will provide free access to the Hood River Pool. And so we will be signing people up. We won't be using punch cards this year. We'll take their name and information. And then we will send a list of those people and their children over to the Hood River Pool, and they'll have a list and create an account. With the Hood River Pool, you have to make a reservation for a slot. You don't just necessarily get to walk in and use the pool. They have quite the requirements over there. And your length of stay won't be as long as it probably was in the past. But they are open to us coming over and using it. We currently have money on account with them. We may not even use up that money that was left over from last year. So we may not even need to use funds that were allocated this year. We will see. The fourth thing is we also want to get information out about the census. The city of White Salmon is dismally below response rates. Our response rate is less than 38% right now. The state of Washington has climbed in response rate. Clickitat County and Goldendale are doing really well. White Salmon and Bingen are not doing well at all. We are not responding to the census for whatever reason. So we're going to have some handouts. Marla's got a banner that she has access to. We're gonna attach it to the railing out here at City Hall, hopefully to get people's attention. So those are kind of the four things we're going to do at the park during Farmers Market from Tuesdays from 4 to 7. For the most part, during office hours, I might try to get Stephanie or Erica to staff it on some days, and then I'll be staffing it after hours from 5 to 7. But we'll have a table there and get stuff handed out, get people that want to use the pool. I know a lot of the people our ladies like to use it for aerobics. I've heard there's like a very long waiting list for aerobics. So I'm not for sure any of our ladies are gonna get to do aerobics in Hood River. Family swim looks a little bit different, Ashley. So we'll have a flyer, we'll have a handout that explains how they need to check the website, how they'll have to make a phone call to make their reservations and all of that.
All right, Bill?
Oh, and one other thing, I just saw a public release. Clickitat County has filed for phase 3. They expect to hear something on that next week. However, I just saw that in one day, they went from 60 cases to 65 cases. So don't know how the State Department of Health will review that.
Bummer.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks, Jen. Bill?
Well, if you guys aren't as lost as I am, you'll realize that Saturday is the 4th of July. Firework. Yeah. With this COVID, I don't even know what day it is most of the time. So Fireworks, White Salmon's ordinance says fireworks are only usable, or you can only shoot off fireworks on the 4th of July. Mm-hmm. I know there's going to be a lot of other people. I've heard some last night already, because I think there's some already being sold at tribal sites. So I don't know how Mike wants to deal with that, or that's up to him on enforcement. But we did have a wildfire set by a lawnmower down at Dickey's Farms on Monday. So that kind of shows me that the grasses and stuff are very dry and are burning very readily. So I want to make sure everybody's very careful with fireworks. Building side, I'm fairly busy on a bunch of inspections and keeping that going. And I'm here for any questions anybody might have for me.
All right. Oh, Dave's got a question.
Bill, just a quick question about fireworks, and I think you sort of answered it, but there is a burn ban in place, so fireworks are allowable on the 4th of July. Probably not advisable, but allowable.
They are allowed by ordinance from 11 o'clock on the 4th to 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. is what our ordinance says.
Okay.
It is what it is. It's be careful out there. The port of Klickitat will not have their site open this year for fireworks. So I've got a feeling that there may be more people doing it in their yards this year. So
Bill, correct me if I'm wrong. If the council would like to change that, don't they have to do that over a year in advance?
If anything changed on from what I understand on the fireworks ordinance, it has to be dealt with over a year in advance of changing anything.
That's
correct. A year and a day.
So it'd have to be done this meeting to deal with next year's ordinances. So, yeah.
Yeah, Benjen went through that.
Yeah, Benjen has a complete no fireworks ordinance. They're the only ones in this area. We matched Klickitat County's ordinance several years ago.
Pat?
Well, the water project's going fairly well. They're doing interties downtown right now to the customers. The new water line is active and being used. So is the old water line at the same time, or portions of it. They keep customers in service until we can swap them all over, and then we'll shut that old system down. Once they get the downtown area done, they're going to bounce down to the hospital and go back up around the hospital, and then they'll work their way back up from there doing the other inner ties back up to the tie-in point around Main or Jewett and Estes, somewhere in there. So they're moving right along, doing fairly well on the project. The contractor is doing a good job out in the field, so happy with the work they're doing. We do have two more stormwater issues we're going to have to deal with in this. I guess we don't have to, but it's definitely a recommendation that we do. Part of our sewer line, our stormwater system, going down the north side of Jewett down to Jewett Creek is plugged up or collapsing, so water's not getting through. This is why we have a lot of bluff water overflow problems that go down the side streets and cause problems. Basically, a dock grade, if we take that catch basin and install a new catch basin there and run it across the road to the north side and tie into the 30-inch, and I have no idea why there's two down both sides, but the 30 inches in good shape, that'll definitely correct the problem there. And we need to do that again at 7th Street. I have prices coming for that. I don't know what that is. LA Reservoir is operating right now, kind of weirdly operating. Our altitude valve, which is electronic altitude valve, got plugged up during this shutting water on and off at bulk, a lot of rust loosed in these old pipes, and it's plugged that up. And the one part that we need to remove, to clean it, the manufacturer accidentally epoxied that in unintentionally, so we can't get it out. So we're gonna have to yank it out and put a new one in. We're gonna go away from the electronic to a hydraulic system. They're a little bit more, they still can get plugged up, but they're a little bit friendlier. But and the other thing we're gonna do is put what's called a rock drop in the line, or debris drop screen systems. So as if material does break loose and comes in, it'll drop down into a screen system and be captured. So it's something that we can easily open up and clean out and not have to tear our whole system apart to get debris out of it, which takes half a day to a day, depending on the situation. It's something we'll be able to do in 5 minutes. So we're working on that. The surveying project for the water line coming in from Buck Creek is been underway and moving forward. This is going to be a long surveying and engineering process because it is a lot of miles of pipe and a lot of figuring out a system that doesn't have a map of how the systems ran out there, and we're having to come up with a plan of how to tie it all back in and eliminate a lot of it, which should eliminate a lot of unnecessary infrastructure out there that's failing besides the main line. And it'll be so basically everything coming in from town from that point will be brand new, including we're going to separate currently well one and well two share a service line coming into the main. We're going to separate those. Primary reason is they should have always been separated. But when we're doing ASR from Buck Creek, we can't run the other well. So if we have a water shortage, we have to shut down doing ASR and turn the well on or Buck Creek back on to come into town. This way in the future that we can get more in the winter months, get more water forced down the ASR for storage capacity. Other than that, just a lot of land use decisions and paperwork going on, nothing major at this point.
Awesome. Any questions for Pat? How about Chief Heppner? Department update?
To take over where Bill left off, the Yakima Nation is not selling fireworks on their spots in town this year. They notified me about a week ago they were not going to do that this year. Not all fireworks are legal during the time that was Bill was pointing out. The ones normally sold at the Yakima Nation properties are usually not legal. Anything that flies through the air, like bottle rockets, anything like that, we will, on the night of the 4th, we will, or before, if they're set them off, we'll take them, because they're not illegal to have. And we'll take them or take them and give a fine, but normally when I offer that, they just say take them. So other than that, anything else you can ask me?
Any questions for Chief Heppner? All right, Russ, department update.
I think Pat covered a big part of it already. We do have a few new services that came in this week and last week, so we are dealing with that. And in between, we are starting to do some pothole repair too.
Nice. Awesome. Ken, I think you're, as far as department heads, last but not.
All right. Okay. Well, I don't know if any of you noticed, but today was supposed to be the day the Governor's Safe Start program was going to expire, but he today extended it through July 9th. Just to a quickie extension to allow him to do some evaluation over the next week or so to, he'll be issuing new proclamations probably late this week or early next week, clarifying any changes to the Safe Start program. And there probably will be some changes, but we don't know exactly where he's going to go with it. As you know from the news, there have been quite a few states that have increased substantially their cases and hospitalizations. So the Governor Inslee is trying to make sure Washington doesn't fall under those same categories. And so it's a little hard to know what he'll do in the next week. So stay tuned.
All right. Thanks. Any council members, committee updates, Ashley?
No committee updates. I did just want to ask if Klickitat County is able to move into phase 3, will City Hall be reopening?
At this time, I've talked with the mayor, and initially we're not going to reopen to City Hall, and a lot of it, because under phase 3, you still have to do the social distancing. We have a very small office. However, my prediction is that phase 4 is a very long way off. based on the governor's remarks lately in the press release, he has a hold right now on phase 4. He's watching, as Ken said, what's going on in the rest of the United States very carefully. He does not want to roll things back, and he doesn't, you know, phase 4 is wide open. I mean, it's like Florida and Texas was. And Arizona wide open as it stands right now. I mean, he could change it and maybe have a phase 4 and a phase 5 or something. But if it looks like phase 4 is a long ways off, then we may have to revisit that. And then we would basically just be allowing one person at a time in the lobby, and people would have to wait outside with the markers on the ground at 6 feet distancing. But we are currently open by appointment, so if people need to drop things off or if they need to pick up building permits, we are doing that by appointment and accommodating them.
Thank you.
And when phase 3 is approved, I will be moving 2 of the 3 City Hall employees back to City Hall.
Great. David?
Just a couple of things. Jan referenced this, but I just happened to be talking to a vendor regarding something to do with work, and they're producing masks. They're a bag manufacturer out of Seattle, and so they asked, they're trying to expand their distribution east of the Cascades. They've distributed something like 80,000 west of the Cascades for free, and sort of latched on to me when I mentioned that was east of the Cascades. And so they're sending me thousands, like their first shipment might be upwards of 5,000. So I have reached out to WAGAP, the school district, the next door, and I'm going to distribute quite a bit to the Yakima Nation. And then I've put some feelers out in Yakima County, which is, you know, obviously a hot spot. So I don't think I'll have a problem distributing them, but if you guys have ideas for organizations, don't send individuals my way, but organizations that are involved in, you know, distributing personal protection equipment, I'd take any leads you have.
I think you've got the main ones.
Yeah, exactly. I just, the Hood River Pool, I'd say my family's used it twice. It is pretty awesome because you kind of have a place to yourself. Word's probably getting out more and more. I think if you use the online portal, you do have to pay in advance. So perhaps calling is the way to go if you're trying to tie into our credit there. Maybe
that's what will have to happen, David, is yeah. You'll have to go online and find your slot and then make a phone call.
Sure. But pretty cool. Glad that that is an option for folks. And then on the policing front, I've been having conversations with Chief Heppner and just about meshed up some schedules to have some ride along. So I'm looking forward to that, to observe and to have some conversations with various officers and bounce ideas and thoughts that, you know, have come to mind as I've been reading and trying to educate myself on the topic. So, and thanks. I don't think I responded to Ken's email, but I reached out to Ken and just asked him what other municipalities in the areas might be doing in regards to reviewing policing reforms. And he got back to me promptly, and it sounded like people were looking into it, but there wasn't a lot of movement at this point.
Great.
That's all I have.
Thanks. Joe?
Nothing for me.
All right. Nothing for me.
You did a great job, Jason.
A-okay, Jason.
All right. Well, we, 2 hours, 49 minutes, or no, 1 hour, 49 minutes. Not bad.
So the conclusion, you can ask whether any further business for the council, and if the answer is no, you can adjourn.
Okay. Is there any other business for the council? Hearing none, we will adjourn.
Thank you. Great.
Thank you, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Thanks. Yeah, you all too. Talk to you later.